Well, it's really nice to see everybody here on this beautiful Lord's Day. You think all that running I'm doing in the heat in the middle of summer is to prepare me for a marathon at some point? Actually, all I'm doing is just training so that I can preach on a day when there's no air conditioning in the auditorium. Well, they say congregations get stronger when they go through the fires of turmoil, and I think this is pretty close to the fires of turmoil, if you ask me. So we're going to be a very strong congregation together after today. Let's have our Bibles open together to James chapter 3. And I've got a text that I'd like to go through this morning in James chapter 3. In particular, we're going to be focusing on the application of wisdom. How do you take wisdom from just mere theory and turn it into wise living? So let's begin in James chapter 3 and verse 13, and we'll go through the end of the chapter together. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder in every evil thing. But the wisdom from above, he says, is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Now that's wisdom applied. So let's look at James chapter 3 and verse 13 a little bit more closely. As one writer says in a book called Faith That Works, a commentary on the book of James, he says, "The assertion is here made that true wisdom and expertise will be displayed by the conduct that is exercised. Mere knowledge is not enough, regardless of how extensive that knowledge is. In the Bible, the wise man is not simply the person who knows the most. Not only facts, but also attitudes are involved. The truly wise man is the conveyor of spiritual truth, and this must be exemplified by a godly life." You don't have to read through the book of Proverbs for very long to see that that is absolutely true. Proverbs is the book on wisdom, and yet when you read from verse to verse, from chapter to chapter, it's not just a book about ideas or knowledge, or philosophy. No, it is an incredibly practical book. Almost every verse in the book of Proverbs touches on some practical application to our daily lives. The wise man in the book of Proverbs is a man who lives his wisdom, who makes good choices in his business, who makes good choices in his relationships, his friendships, his marriage. He's a man who uses his money well and practices charity and takes care of the people around him, who builds up his friendships with other people in the right way. The wise man is a man who talks the right things, who says the right things, who's kind and compassionate in everything that he does. He lives his wisdom. He doesn't merely think his wisdom in a coffee shop while stroking his beard. That's wisdom. At least that's how God would define wisdom. Notice here in James 3, verse 13. Who among you is wise and understanding? That's a challenge, isn't it? That's a challenge to everyone who thinks he's wise and understanding. If you think you're so smart, if you think you're so wise, I've got one thing to say to you, James says. Let him show by his good behavior what kind of wisdom he has. If you say you're wise and understanding, that's fine. You talk the talk, but do you walk the walk of a truly wise person? I guess I don't care so much about theoretical wisdom. I'm not sure how much that has really helped anybody. I'm not sure how much mere knowledge really helps people along the way in this life. And I understand you have to have a knowledge base to do some things in this life. You have to know how to drive a car if you're going to drive a car safely. So knowledge and discretion and wisdom, they do play a part in how we live. You can't cook certain things unless you know a little bit about cooking. You can't be successful in your marriage unless you learn a few things about how to be married. And the same is true of how we raise our children or how we conduct ourselves in a business or a job. Knowledge is valuable, but knowledge without application really means nothing. Think about the person who spends his entire life studying the Bible. Whether it's a monk or simply somebody who's a theologian who lives in an office cloistered away from the world, and he studies and he studies and he studies and he knows so much, and he knows the Bible cover to cover, and he can quote Scripture verbatim from any book in the Bible. And he knows the Greek, and he knows the Hebrew, and he knows his language, his grammar, and his syntax. And he can quote great thinkers from ages past. But if he never gets out and applies that knowledge, what has he done? The Great Commission is not about mere knowledge. The Great Commission is about go into all the world and preach to them the gospel. You've got to make disciples. And being cloistered away in an office or a monastery is not the same thing as making disciples. So if you are wise and understanding, if that's what you claim to be, here's your challenge. Show it. Show it by good behavior, by deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. And notice that wisdom is not abrasive. Wisdom is gentle. Wisdom is not offensive. Wisdom is not a blunt object. Wisdom is not a weapon to be used to hurt other people. Let him show his good behavior and his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But applied wisdom lies in stark contrast to what he has to say in verse 14. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. Be very careful, because sometimes great knowledge can destroy your reputation, and it can destroy your influence. It can destroy who you are and who you're supposed to be. Watch out, because mere knowledge can sometimes be more hurtful than helpful. And a lot of it just boils down to motive. Look at the motives he describes here. If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't be arrogant and so lie against the truth. Now, is it just that jealousy and ambition themselves are the problem, or is it the attitude behind those things? Now, we know that God is described as a jealous God in other passages. So clearly, it's not just the jealousy itself. Jealousy is a morally neutral thing, just like every emotion. Anger is morally neutral. Joy is morally neutral. They're all morally neutral. Emotions are just emotions. They're simply responses to stimulation. It's what you do with those emotions that is moral. It's the attitude behind them, how you use those emotions, that determine whether they're moral or immoral. Jealousy is simply an emotion. And God is a jealous God. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 makes that point. The Apostle Paul was jealous. He had a jealousy for them, the Corinthians, that is. It's not jealousy itself. It's the kind of jealousy. It's bitter jealousy. And ambition is the same way. Ambition drives us to climb mountains. Ambition drives us to improve ourselves in our job performance. Ambition drives us to an A+ instead of a B-. Ambition can drive us to do great things. So it's not the ambition itself that's the problem. It's the selfish ambition that's the issue. Go to the book of Philippians and notice an attitude problem that existed as Paul describes it in Philippians chapter 1, here beginning in verse, for the sake of context, let's start in verse 12 just for context's sake. Now I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everybody else. And that most of the brethren, he says, most, that's a key word there, trusting in the Lord because of my imprisonment, have far more courage to speak the word of God without fear. Now, some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife. There's the attitude there. Envy and strife. But some also from goodwill. Now, the latter do it out of love, knowing that I'm appointed for the defense of the gospel. But the former, verse 17, The former proclaimed Christ out of, well, there's that same word in James 3, right? They proclaim it out of selfish ambition. Selfish ambition. Now again, the right kind of ambition drives you to preach the gospel to other people. The right kind of ambition says, where we are as a church now isn't where we need to be. So let's drive ourselves to be better so that a year from now, or 5 years, or 10 years down the road, we're a better congregation. We're a bigger congregation, just in terms of numbers and also in terms of the growth in our faith. Ambition drives us to do those things. But this kind of ambition, this Philippians 1 or this James 3 ambition, that kind of ambition is a selfish ambition that seeks for glory. It's the kind of ambition that says, hey, I heard that Paul baptized 15 people while he was in Philippi. I heard that he taught that he had like 20 Bible studies going on in Ephesus while he was there. Well, I'll tell you what, let's go to Ephesus and let's get 30 Bible studies going, and then we'll go to Philippi, and then we'll baptize 20 people in Philippi, and we'll sure show that Paul thinks he's so special because he's an apostle. He thinks he's so special. He gets to fall on his sword and live in a prison cell and act like a martyr all day long. Well, we'll sure show him. Now, Paul's response is, I guess the gospel's being preached, and that's a good thing. And I'm happy the gospel's being preached. But those people aren't helping themselves. They're not helping themselves. And maybe at the end of your life, you can look at your selfish ambition and say, yes, but I made this much money. And I became a CEO or the president of a company. Or I own this much property. Or I did this great thing. Or I won this award or this accomplishment. And my selfish ambition drove me to all of these great things. And we might even say the same thing about our work as Christians. I wanted to look good for Christ, so I came every Sunday. And I pulled my peg, unlike a lot of other people. And I taught a lot of people in Bible classes. And I baptized a lot of people. And I looked the part, and I did what I was supposed to. And I suppose God's response would be like Paul's in Philippians 1. Well, I'm glad for their sakes that so many people got taught. And I'm glad that in a sense your example might have helped somebody else come to the gospel. But you weren't helping yourself. Your selfishness sunk your spiritual ship. You destroyed it. Now, that's not applied wisdom. Now, he takes it a step further here in verse 15 and 16 of our text. This wisdom, okay, and he says this wisdom. I believe he's saying that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, right? It's not real wisdom. It's this wisdom. A few minutes ago, Austin talked about artificial sweeteners, right? Artificial sweeteners, they're never really the same thing. And there is a difference. You can tell the difference. Now, there's some artificial sweeteners that are better than others. But Austin and I were talking the other day about the different kinds of Cokes out there. You got your Coca-Cola, and you've got your Diet Coke, and you've got your Coke Zero, and you've got your cane sugar Coke. And there's like other things as well, right? There's even a new one that's come out recently as well. You might say, this is real Coca-Cola over here. This is Coca-Cola. But then you point to some out, and you go, and then there's that Coca-Cola, that stuff over there off to the side. I think that's what James is talking about. This wisdom, it's not real wisdom, but this kind of wisdom, this cheap, selfish imitation wisdom, this wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, it's natural, it's demonic. Those are some pretty harsh descriptions of that kind of wisdom, right? Earthly, natural, demonic. Now, what do all those things have in common? Now, the earthly and the natural, what they have in common is that it's kind of world-bound. It's worldly wisdom. But then there's that demonic side to it also. So what's the thread that holds all three of those things together? The thread is that they don't come from God. That's the difference. True wisdom comes from above as its ultimate source. Every other kind of wisdom, Some of it's earthly. Some of it's just from nature, from human mind. Some of it comes from the demons, born in the heart and the lies of Satan, who is the father of all lies. True wisdom comes from above. Go back to the book of Proverbs and notice a verse here. In Proverbs chapter 9, and notice what the writer has to say here in Proverbs 9 and verse 10. In the context of a really great passage, by the way, that was read for our scripture reading earlier in our worship, look at verse 10 here. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is the beginning of understanding. You want wisdom and understanding? You want the true smarts? Well, it starts with God. It starts with God. And if your wisdom doesn't start with God, if your wisdom started from the preconception or the preset idea of worldly things, earthly things, natural things, and that would include atheism, that would include naturalism, secularism, or evolution, that would include all of those ideas, that if you have preconceived an idea or a wisdom or a knowledge that has decided in advance that there is no God involved. That's the kind of wisdom James is talking about. And it's not true wisdom. You want wisdom and understanding, it has to start with the fear of the Lord and the knowledge of the Holy One. What do you think of these descriptors here? Earthly, natural, demonic. Now, earthly is not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, there are a lot of earthly things. Dogs are earthly. Your car is earthly. Your physical body is earthly. Being earthly isn't inherently wrong. But if the source of your wisdom is earthly, well, then you become just like Romans chapter 1, right? In Romans 1, it talks about the way that they got rid of faith in God. They got rid of giving glory to the Creator and instead transferred that glory, that praise, that worship to the creation. And they loved the creation rather than the Creator. If your wisdom is an earthly kind of wisdom, it's a false wisdom. Well, the same thing goes with being natural, right? Now, some things come very naturally to us, and there are natural urges that we have that are not inherently wrong. We have a natural urge for food. We have a natural urge for water. We have a natural urge for companionship, whether it be romantic or simply friendship. We have a natural desire for those kinds of things. But again, if your wisdom just comes from that which is natural, maybe in modern vernacular, if your wisdom is just coming from that which feels right at the moment, it's a false wisdom. And need I really say anything more about the wisdom that comes from the demons? That's a wisdom that's demonic? Do you really want to subscribe to a wisdom that is demonic? A wisdom that comes from the heart of Satan? For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder in every evil thing. Great point about this verse here. Disorder in every evil thing started with a bad attitude. Disorder in every evil thing started with a bad attitude. When you have that bitter jealousy that was described earlier, when you have that selfish ambition, when you do subscribe to things that are nothing but earthbound, what feels right at the time, or created by Satan, what starts as a bad attitude is the seed for disorder and every evil thing. That's all encompassing then. That's all encompassing. Disorder and every evil thing. Now, this is why I've said this in other sermons before. But I've been asked in the past, like, what really is the core sin? Like, if you could sum up all sins as, like, one core problem, one key problem, it's selfishness, isn't it? It's selfishness. And I think that's what this verse is saying. The selfish ambition, the bitter jealousy. Bitter jealousy has at its core just selfishness. The idea that somebody has what I want and I don't have it, so I'm angry right now. The idea that somebody is successful and I'm not and I wish I had their success, it's selfishness. Selfishness is the core problem with disorder and every evil thing. And notice how that kind of wisdom produces disorder in your life. I observe in the life of the sinner that chaos and disorder exist in the life of the sinner. When I was going through college, what seemed like forever ago, because you know you have a whole lifetime between college and now, right? You get married and you move places and you get a job and you have kids. It seems like so long ago, but I don't think college has changed all that much. But when you look at the lives of a lot of the college professors that I knew, and I'm not judging, by the way, I'm simply observing life as they live it. These are the most intelligent people in our culture, the professors at the universities. But they can't seem to figure out almost anything else in life. These same professors who are experts in their field can't seem to maintain relationships with a husband or a wife. They're estranged from their children. They have no idea morally what they believe. They're floundering around trying to figure out. They're morally floundering around trying to figure out, is a fetus a human being, right? A genetically distinctive human being with a brain and a heart that can feel pain, and they don't seem to understand what that means. That's disorder. That's disorder in every evil thing. And it stems from that worldly wisdom, which has as its core selfishness. Plain and simple, run-of-the-mill, has existed since Genesis chapter 3, selfishness. Verses 17 and 18. But the wisdom from above, he says, is first pure. I like that it's first pure. He goes out of his way to say it is first something, right? If he didn't mean for that to have some meaning, he wouldn't have said first. He would have simply said the wisdom from above is pure, and then it's this, and then it's this. But he goes out of his way to point out that it is of first importance, that is, at its core, it begins with this thing. It is first pure. It's pure. We want pure things, don't we? In the 21st century, you know, maybe our parents and grandparents grew up in the age where the microwave was the great miracle and freeze-dried food and that sort of thing. And that was the great miracle of that time period. And a lot of people were fed because of that. And I think that dealt with a problem at the time period, especially during the Great Depression, the advent of those kinds of convenience food sources. But in the 21st century, for some reason, our culture has said the pendulum has shifted way back the other way. And now if it doesn't say non-GMO on the front of a food package, we cast it aside as if it's got black plague all over it. And we want our beef grass-fed, right? So people line up to talk to Jason because we know his beef is the best. And that's not a joke. It is the best. We know that. We want things to be pure, don't we? And that's why cane sugar soda is so popular, because you want to turn a bottle around and you want to see like 3 ingredients on there, not 25 ingredients, most of which you can't pronounce. We like things to be pure, don't we? We want pure gold when we buy something. We love the pure. And he says, this is a wisdom that's pure. God's wisdom is unadulterated wisdom. It's unfiltered wisdom. It's uncorrupted wisdom. It's wisdom that comes from the divine mind, not a mind that has ulterior motives or dirty thoughts or abuse on its mind. It is pure. It is first pure, then peaceable. It's peaceable. It creates peace. It fosters peace. He also says it's gentle. I've always liked 2 Timothy chapter 2, by the way, on the point of it being peaceable and gentle. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, beginning in verse 22, he tells Timothy that the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be patient and kind and gentle and able to teach, even when he's wrong, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition. The Lord's bondservant looks at a world full of infighting and rudeness and arguing, and the Lord's bondservant says, surely there's a better way. Surely we can find the way of peace and the way of gentleness. That's what the Lord's bondservant is looking for in God's wisdom. But it's also reasonable. It's a reasonable kind of wisdom. It's not ridiculous wisdom. You don't read things in the book of Proverbs or in the book of Ecclesiastes. You're not reading things out of the Sermon on the Mount going like, wow, now that's just, that comes from left field. That's, I don't know, Jesus, that's kind of a strange idea, isn't it? It's reasonable. It's reasonable wisdom. It's wisdom that makes sense. It's wisdom that has some utility behind it. It's wisdom that when you take it apart and peel the layers back and look at its core, you go, yeah, you know what? That works. It's got moving parts. Everything's necessary. It works. It's reasonable. It's full of mercy and good fruits. Full of mercy and good fruits. That's what wisdom produces. Wisdom will never make you bitter. Wisdom is never going to turn your stomach like bad fruit. You know, when you pick up a nectarine, nectarines are the most fickle of all the fruits, by the way. When you find a good nectarine, you just want to find a chair and sit down with your eyes closed. But when you find a bad nectarine, you can't even finish it. One bite of a nectarine and you get to know what kind of nectarine it is. Can you tell it's my off and on favorite fruit? We have a very shaky relationship, nectarines and me. But God's wisdom will never turn your stomach. It's always just right. Full of mercy and good fruits. It's unwavering. It's true. Never changes. It's unwavering. It's without hypocrisy. And the seed, and I love verse 18 as we bring our lesson to a close. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So we get back to applied wisdom. That's the whole point of our lesson, isn't it? What does wisdom look like in real life? We know what it looks like on the page, and we can read the book of Proverbs. The wise man does this and the fool does that. Okay. Seems simple enough, doesn't it? No. You've got to live it. The seed whose fruit is righteousness, and righteousness is a thing. It's an action. It's manifested in your life in some way. Is sown in peace, not just by those who want peace or who understand peace theoretically or can read about peace. It's sown in peace by those who make peace. Does that describe you? Or does the selfish ambition and bitter jealousy describe you more? Does the wisdom from above describe you? Or is an earthly, a natural, demonic wisdom closer to your heart? My friends, you have an opportunity right now, as you do at every moment of your life, as long as breath still passes between your lips, you have an opportunity to become a heaven-bound person, to become a heavenly person in the way that you walk and live and think and act in this life. Won't you listen to the gospel message, which is summed up so beautifully in Mark 16, verse 16? He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. It really is as simple as that. Won't you listen to the wisdom of God and make that your wisdom, your defining mindset, your application? Apply it now. Live it now. Don't wait until tomorrow, because tomorrow might not come. Whatever spiritual need you have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.